You're about to walk into like a vendor meeting that could honestly cost your company millions of dollars.
Yeah. And let's be real, budgets in 2026 are just completely unforgiving right now.
Exactly. A bad technology purchase doesn't just sting anymore, it actually gets people fired.
Oh, absolutely.
You are no longer in this era where you can just afford to write off a software mistake and, I don't know, try again next quarter. So today, we are building your bulletproof toolkit.
I love that. A toolkit is exactly what people need.
Right. We are taking a really practical inside look at this 2026 framework. It's titled QA Testing Strategy for Custom Software: What Stakeholders Should Expect.
Yeah, and that was put together by a group called Technegen out in Southern California, right?
Yes, exactly. But the mission of this deep dive today is totally universal. We're giving you the exact blueprint to, evaluate risk, vet your vendors, and honestly, just judge your own internal readiness before you sign a single contract.
Which is so critical before any ink hits the paper.
For sure. Okay, let's unpack this because buying tech right now is entirely about surviving like constrained capital and these astronomical security stakes. And I mean, most leadership teams are going into these decisions completely blind.
They really are. And, the landscape has just fundamentally shifted.
How so?
Well, for a long time, cheap capital basically allowed organizations to operate with this whole fail fast mentality.
Right, just buy something and see if it works.
Exactly. You'd buy a massive platform, deploy it, realize it doesn't quite fit your operations, and then you just like patch it with manual labor and buy something else a year later.
Which is just wild to think about now.
Oh, yeah. That era is completely over. The mandate now is immediate, measurable return on investment. And usually they want to see that within the same fiscal year.
Wow, the same year. That is a tight turnaround.
It is. What's fascinating here is how this framework identifies the true starting point of a tech purchase. It almost always begins with a distress signal.
A distress signal. Okay, wait, I like that. You mean like the search term itself?
Exactly that.
Because when a director or, a VP actually sits down and types QA testing strategy custom software into a search bar, they aren't just casually browsing for weekend reading.
No, definitely not.
They are searching for a cure because they already know their operational system is bleeding. I mean, there is a massive gap in their current state, and they're just trying to put a name to the pain.
Yeah, and those gaps, they manifest in very specific, highly destructive ways.
Like what? What are we looking for?
We are talking about critical operational risk or deeply unclear ownership where, literally nobody knows who is responsible for a system failure.
Oh, that's the worst. The blame game.
Exactly. Or it's weak documentation or reporting that is so inconsistent you can't actually trust your own company's data.
Right. But I feel like searching for this stuff is kind of like Googling your symptoms on WebMD.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Because by the time you are actively searching for a QA testing strategy, you already know something is deeply sick in your operational process.
Spot on. And, the most dangerous symptom that drives the search is realizing your primary vendor relationship is built on, well, blind trust rather than verifiable process.
Ah, yeah. You suddenly realize the vendor holds all the cards and your internal team is just reacting to whatever they say.
Which puts the leadership team in a highly, highly vulnerable position.
Because when you're bleeding operations and feeling that kind of panic, you just want a quick fix. You want the polished sales rep to walk in and say, "Hey, trust me, our software will solve all of your reporting issues."
And that is the trap. Operating in a state of panic is the easiest way to fall right into a sales trap.
So how does the framework handle that?
Well, the entire framework is designed to force leaders to slow that decision down just enough to shift the dynamic. You have to move it from trust me to prove it.
I mean, the instinct is to just adopt a tool-first approach, right?
Exactly. You see a sophisticated piece of software with a gorgeous interface, you buy it, and then you spend the next 2 years agonizingly trying to bend your existing business processes to fit how the software was coded.
Which is backwards.
Completely backwards. The framework demands an outcome-first approach. You have to completely ignore the tools initially.
Wait, really? Just ignore the tools completely.
Completely. You first must define exactly what business process is failing, what specific risk is keeping the board up at night, and what single metric will prove that progress is happening.
So you basically draw the target before you even look at the arrows.
That is exactly it.
But you can't draw that target without putting specific names to the process. right? I mean, this is where the framework gets incredibly tactical with its internal ownership model.
Yes, the four pillars. This is huge.
Right, there are four distinct roles that have to be established before you take a single vendor meeting.
Walk us through them.
Okay, so first, you need an executive sponsor. That's someone with the actual budget and the authority to aggressively remove blockers.
Crucial.
Then you need a business owner, the one who defines the actual outcomes.
Right, the person who actually needs the problem solved.
Exactly. Then a technical owner who basically validates if the internal infrastructure can actually handle the integration. And finally, an operational reviewer.
And they are the ones who confirm if this tool will actually survive contact with the day-to-day workers, right?
The people on the floor. But honestly, I have to push back on this a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
Put yourself in the shoes of a CTO or an operations director right now. The servers are basically on fire. Your competitors are moving faster than you, and budgets are locked down tight.
Yeah, it's a high-pressure environment.
So doesn't slowing down to assign four distinct, highly structured ownership roles just create this mountain of bureaucratic red tape? Like, doesn't it kill a project's momentum before it even gets off the ground?
It definitely feels counterintuitive when you are trying to move fast, but we have to look at the mechanics of why tech projects actually fail.
Okay, why do they fail?
Establishing these four roles isn't creating red tape. It is preemptively cutting the tape that will strangle you at month three.
Month three. Why month three specifically?
Because the majority of enterprise tech failures don't happen on day one. Everyone's excited on day one. They happen in a slow motion collapse around month three or four when a really critical workflow decision has to be made.
I see.
If you don't have this ownership model, everyone suddenly points at each other. Marketing points at IT, IT points at operations.
Because nobody actually owns the outcome.
Precisely. The project stalls out. The vendor keeps billing you for idle hours and nothing actually gets delivered.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. If you only have a business owner, you might buy vaporware that destroys your database. If you only have a technical owner, you build a perfectly secure, elegantly coded system that the floor staff flat out refuses to use.
Because it adds, like, 14 clicks to their daily workflow.
Exactly. Huh. The friction between these four roles is completely intentional. It forces feasibility. Slowing down for a week to establish this tension saves you 6 months of agonizing, expensive delays later on.
Okay, so that makes the internal preparation really clear. You have your four owners, you know your desired outcome, and you finally step into the market.
Right, now you're ready to talk to vendors.
So you're sitting across from a vendor who has a very slick slide deck. How do you evaluate them? I know this framework relies on four anchor questions that you basically have to ask before signing anything.
These four questions are honestly the ultimate filter. They separate a genuine technology partner from a vendor who is just trying to hit a quarterly sales quota.
Let's hear them.
Question one, what evidence supports the recommendation? Question two, who owns the outcome after the launch?
Okay, evidence and post-launch ownership.
Yep. Question three, what risks are we handling before implementation? And question four, how exactly will success be measured at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks?
And those questions feed directly into the scorecard criteria, right? Mm-hmm. We're looking at things like implementation quality, cost transparency, scalability, and security. Yeah. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The framework insists that every single one of these criteria must be scored with evidence, not promises.
Which is a huge distinction.
But in the middle of a high-pressure pitch, how do you practically distinguish between the two? I mean, a good sales rep can make a promise sound exactly like evidence.
It's tough. You have to look for the mechanics of the solution, not just the confirmation of your request.
What do you mean by mechanics?
Okay, a promise is a vendor looking at your list of requirements and saying, yes, our system integrates seamlessly with your current CRM.
Right, just a verbal yes.
Exactly. Evidence is that same vendor sliding a detailed workflow diagram across the table showing the exact API endpoints, the data mapping, and the specific security protocols for that integration.
Oh, wow. That is a massive difference.
A promise is we offer great post-launch support. Evidence is a documented set of service-level expectations, guaranteed response times, and a clear escalation hierarchy mapped out right there in the contract.
It's literally the difference between someone telling me they can build a bridge and showing me the structural blueprints for the bridge.
Yes, and it actually goes deeper than blueprints.
How so?
True evidence of expertise is a vendor's willingness to acknowledge real-world trade-offs.
Oh, like pushing back on a request.
Exactly. If a vendor says yes to every single custom feature you ask for without any hesitation, you should be terrified.
Because nothing is that easy.
Right. A trustworthy partner will look at your request and say, well, we can build this custom reporting module, but it will increase your latency by 3 seconds and add 20% to the maintenance budget. So here is what we recommend avoiding instead.
They prove their competence by showing you the guardrails.
Exactly that.
Which highlights the warning signs of a bad vendor.
Mm.
I mean, vague scope is an obvious red flag, but the framework points out hidden maintenance pricing under cost transparency.
Oh, that is a huge one.
Because the initial bill might look incredibly cheap, right? But the vendor retains all the intellectual property and charges astronomical hourly rates for basic updates down the line.
Yeah, it's basically a hostage situation disguised as a discount.
So true.
But you know, the most critical red flag ties back to that fourth anchor question.
The 30, 60, 90 day metrics.
Yes. If a vendor cannot articulate exactly how the work will be measured and evaluated after the launch, the initiative is dead on arrival.
Wow. Dead on arrival.
If they can't clearly describe the milestones of those first 90 days, they are just selling you a deployment, not an actual solution.
Let's talk about the mechanics of those first 90 days then. Because even if a vendor passes your strict evaluation and provides all the structural evidence you asked for, you still aren't really safe, are you?
No, not at all.
The moment the contract is signed, the clock starts on the most dangerous phase, which is the rollout. So how does this framework prevent a custom software implementation from becoming this chaotic, open-ended money pit?
By enforcing the 90-day success plan.
Okay, break that down for us.
The psychology behind this is vital. In enterprise technology, there is this massive gravitational pull toward the sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, for sure. People just don't want to admit they wasted money.
Exactly. Teams will pour millions of dollars and years of effort into a failing agile transformation simply because they don't have a structured stopping point to evaluate if it's actually working.
So the 90-day plan forces a hard executive checkpoint.
That's right.
Looking at the structure here, it says the first 30 days are purely about clarifying the current state and identifying priority gaps.
Right. No building yet. Just understanding.
Then days 31 through 60 are strictly for implementing or piloting the highest value improvement. So you aren't boiling the ocean. You are just proving the concept on one critical workflow.
Exactly. Keep it contained.
And then days 61 through 90 are dedicated to reviewing those results, documenting the lessons learned, and making a cold, calculated decision on whether to continue, expand, or just kill the approach.
It creates a forcing function for accountability.
Right.
You know, you don't have to wait 18 months and burn through your entire capital expenditure budget just to find out if the software is viable.
That makes total sense.
And this ties into the broader phased implementation roadmap, where the initial pilot is designed to be small enough to execute quickly, but detailed enough to expose the underlying risks of the organization's data structure.
Which brings up a very specific rollout mistake that teams make constantly. The framework warns against over-customizing before validating the core process.
Yes, this is so common.
In a technical environment, that feels like the equivalent of trying to optimize a complex database query before you have even confirmed that your database schema is actually correct.
Right, you are refining something that might need to be completely torn down anyway.
It's like picking out custom silk curtains before you've even checked if the concrete foundation of the house has set.
That is a perfect analogy. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is the vanity trap of technology.
The vanity trap. I like that.
Yeah, because customizing user interfaces, tweaking dashboard colors, and building out highly specific minor features, it feels like tangible progress. It gives this illusion of momentum.
But it's not real momentum.
No. If the core data processing doesn't work, you are just painting a car that doesn't have an engine. This is exactly why measuring progress correctly is the linchpin of the entire operation.
The framework mandates measuring progress with a mix of business, technical, and operational indicators. So we're talking about things like downtime reduction, lead quality, conversion rates, and, you know, the elimination of manual data entry steps.
But the absolute critical mechanism here is that these metrics must be locked in before the implementation even begins.
Before it begins. Why is that so important?
Because if you wait until the software is rolled out to decide how you are going to measure success, human nature takes over.
People want to look good.
Exactly. Teams will instinctively look at whatever the software happens to be doing passably well and invent a success narrative to justify the spend.
Oh, I've seen that happen. They'll say, well, our downtime didn't actually improve and the conversion rate is flat, but hey, Look at the incredible volume of user logins we have.
Right. You have to establish the failure conditions up front, or you will literally never admit when a project has failed.
And part of avoiding failure is managing the psychology of your end users. There's a rollout mistake detail here that I just see all the time, and it is an absolute adoption killer.
What's that?
Leaving old workflows running parallel to the new custom software.
The manual spreadsheet problem?
Exactly that. You spend $500,000 on a new automated inventory management system, but you leave the old clunky Excel spreadsheet accessible on the shared drive, just in case.
And what always happens?
Under pressure, human beings will always default to the path of least resistance. The new software requires learning a new interface, whereas the spreadsheet is familiar.
Yep.
If you don't burn the boats and shut down the old workflow, your employees will quietly abandon the new system, which completely undermines the investment.
It happens every single time.
My biggest fear with these massive custom rollouts, though, is the hit by a bus scenario.
Oh, yeah. The knowledge gap.
Right. Let's say we navigate the 90 days perfectly. Yeah. The software is live. The spreadsheets are deleted. Adoption is super high. Then your lead technical owner leaves for a competitor, or the vendor gets acquired and changes their entire service model.
It happens faster than you'd think.
Suddenly, your custom system is just a black box. So how does this framework prevent that specific nightmare?
It prevents it through the two unsung heroes of 2026 technology strategy: relentless documentation and integrated security.
Okay, let's dive into the security mechanics first, because the framework makes it aggressively clear that security is no longer an optional compliance checkbox at the end of a project.
Not at all.
Even if an organization is just buying a seemingly benign marketing analytics tool, they are required to protect credentials, customer information, API access, and administrative privileges. And they cite heavy standards here, like OWASP and ISO.
Yeah.
For a lot of leaders, that sounds like massive overkill for just a marketing tool.
It definitely sounds like overkill until you understand how lateral movement works in modern cyber attacks.
Lateral movement. Explain that.
Well, modern software is deeply interconnected via APIs. That marketing tool needs to pull data, so the vendor asks for read and write access to your core customer relationship management system.
Right, your CRM.
If that marketing vendor has weak security and gets breached, the attackers don't stop at the marketing tool. They use that trusted API token to move laterally directly into your core CRM.
Oh, wow.
And from there, potentially right into your financial databases.
That is terrifying.
It is. That is why the framework insists that you have to interrogate how data is protected, how changes are logged, and how incidents are escalated, regardless of whether the tool is managing your payroll or literally just tracking email clicks.
So the vulnerability of your Snellest vendor is your vulnerability.
Exactly.
And that strict discipline ties directly into documentation. The framework treats documentation not as an afterthought, but as a living insurance policy.
It is your only safety net.
It mandates decision notes, architecture diagrams, configuration records, and a comprehensive change history.
Documentation is exactly how you survive that hit by a bus scenario you mentioned.
Because the knowledge is trapped in one person's head otherwise.
Right. When a new engineering team inherits a custom software system, like 3 years after it was built, they don't just need to know how the code works. They desperately need to know why specific architectural decisions were made.
Oh, that makes sense. The context.
Yeah. Without decision notes, they might try to fix a piece of code that was actually a deliberate workaround for a legacy database quirk. And in doing so, they bring the whole system down.
So documentation transfers the knowledge from an individual's brain into the company's asset column.
Perfectly said.
Which leads directly to what I consider the most fascinating and, frankly, the most confrontational part of this entire strategy.
Okay, what's that?
The concept of exit readiness.
Yeah.
The framework dictates that before a project even starts, while you are still in the honeymoon phase of the vendor pitch, you must demand data export options.
Yep.
You have to confirm who owns the underlying code and detail the exact administrative handoff steps if the relationship ends.
So what does this all mean?
It's intense.
It is. You are sitting across from a vendor. They are promising you this frictionless future, and you essentially ask for a prenup on the first date.
That's a great way to think about it.
You say, this all sounds wonderful. Now document exactly how we fire you and extract all our data.
It feels very confrontational, but this raises an important question about the true nature of a business partnership.
How so?
The instinct is to assume that demanding exit readiness will offend the vendor or signal a lack of trust. In reality, a truly disciplined enterprise-grade partner expects this conversation.
Really? They aren't offended? No, because willingly providing clear exit readiness is the ultimate psychological test of a vendor's integrity. It proves that their business model relies on delivering continuous value and excellent process to keep you as a client.
Rather than relying on technical lock-in and just holding your data hostage,
exactly,
it shifts the leverage entirely. The framework notes that bringing in an independent consultant-like technician who authored this can be highly strategic at this specific stage.
Very strategic.
I bring them in before the ink is dry.
Yeah.
While you still have the leverage to demand those detailed workflow diagrams and enforce that exit readiness. Because the moment that contract is signed and the budget is committed, your ability to demand a prenup drops to zero.
Absolutely zero. You have to scope the boundaries of the relationship up front.
Right.
You define what happens on day one, who owns the outcome on day 90, and exactly how the entire apparatus can be safely dismantled in year three, if necessary.
Which brings this entire framework full circle. A QA testing strategy for custom software in 2026 is clearly not some technical checklist meant for the IT basement.
No, not at all.
It is a rigorous, highly disciplined framework for executive control. I mean, it is about actively managing risk, assigning unavoidable internal ownership so projects don't silently stall out, and demanding verifiable mechanics rather than relying on a polished sales pitch.
It really takes the leadership team out of a reactive, panicked state of diagnosing symptoms and equips them to engineer actual, durable solutions.
So to you listening right now, the next time you find yourself walking into a technology vendor meeting, feeling the pressure of constrained budgets and the anxiety of potential security flaws, remember that you have the toolkit to control the room.
You absolutely do.
Do not let the slide deck dictate the pace. Fall back on your anchor questions. Ask them, you know, what is the mechanical evidence supporting this recommendation? Who internally is going to own this outcome?
Ask what specific risks are being mitigated before the launch.
Yes. And how exactly are we measuring success at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks? Demand the blueprints, not the promises.
I love that. And as we close out today, I'd like to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on the psychology of that exit readiness concept we talked about.
Okay, let's hear it.
We discussed how a vendor's willingness to plan for the end of a contract is the truest test of their discipline and integrity. It proves they aren't relying on holding you hostage.
Right.
It makes you wonder, how might applying that exact same exit readiness standard change the way we evaluate our own internal hires or our long-term business partnerships?
Oh, wow.
If we started every professional relationship by clearly, maturely defining how it could safely and respectfully end, would we actually build stronger, more honest foundations from day one?
Applying the prenup logic to our internal corporate culture. That is a heavy, fascinating shift in how we structure trust.
It's something to think about.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions, demand the evidence, and remember, the next time you're tempted to buy a shiny new tool just to soothe an operational panic, take a breath, establish your owners, and draw the target before you shoot. Catch you next time.